For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, if you missed our study in Exodus, I just want to spend a few minutes getting you up to speed on what's happened in this book so far. The book of Exodus is the second book in our Bible. It's a very ancient book, about 3,500 years old. So far in the book of Exodus, in the previous several chapters, we saw that Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, has been rocking Egypt with plague after plague. You know, the Israelites were in bondage and slavery to the Egyptians, and God sent this guy named Moses to Pharaoh and told him to let my people go. Pharaoh said no. And so what we really have is a standoff here, really an arm wrestling match between God and Pharaoh. What God is really doing here is he's demonstrating his superiority and giving a witness to anyone who will listen. He's showing them that, you know, I am superior to all of the so-called made-up gods that you guys have come up with. And we saw last time how, you know, in plague after plague, he demonstrated his superiority over this particular god, over that particular god. But he's also proclaiming a witness. He's letting both the Israelites and the Egyptians know that he is God. He's the only one. And he's giving them an opportunity to place their trust in him. Well, Pharaoh says no for the final time in the ninth plague, which we saw was an attack on the sun god, where he brought darkness over the entire land for 3 days. And we ended our study last time with these two verses in Exodus 10. Pharaoh said to Moses, "Get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again. For the day you see my face, you shall die." So he says, if I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you. And Moses says, you are right, I shall never see your face again. And so Pharaoh violates this, kind of like this freedom of the press they had for prophets back in the day, where the prophet was supposed to be able to say what he you know, felt like the deity was telling him to say. And he violates this and threatens Moses' life. And Moses says, you're right, you won't see my face again. And this would be the last time he would ever see Pharaoh. But Moses takes this occasion to tell Pharaoh about the tenth and final plague. And so we see in verse 1 of chapter 11, we see a little bit of a flashback for what Moses had been told by God already. It says, Yahweh had said to Moses, "I will strike Pharaoh and the land of Egypt with one more blow." This attack would be directly on Pharaoh, who was considered to be the god of the sun, the son of the sun god. So he was considered divine in his own right. He says, after that, Pharaoh will let you leave this country. In fact, he'll be so eager to get rid of you that he will force you all to leave. Tell all the Israelite men and women to ask their Egyptian neighbors for articles of silver and gold. Remember this plundering of the Egyptians that's been talking about again and again, where they're going to leave with great wealth from the Egyptians. They're just going to give them like their life savings in order to get them out of there. Now, Yahweh had caused the Egyptians to look favorably on the people of Israel. And Moses was considered a very great man in the land of Egypt, respected by Pharaoh's officials and the Egyptian people alike. You know, basically anybody with 1 ounce of sense could tell that Yahweh was real, Yahweh was winning, Yahweh was going to win, things were not going to turn around in this contest. And they saw that Moses was at the head of this, that he was God's man that God had chosen to speak through. And so, you know, we saw even as early as the third plague that Pharaoh's own magicians were like, this is the finger of God. And then, you know, by the sixth plague, the rest of his employees, his direct reports were saying, dude, you've got to wake up here and let them go. You're destroying this nation. Well, by this point, everybody could see, you know, apparently everybody could see things clearly the way that they were, that Yahweh was the supreme God. And so Moses announced to Pharaoh, this is what Yahweh says, about midnight, I will pass through the heart of Egypt. So Yahweh himself is going to come down. He says, all the firstborn will die in every family in Egypt. The plague of death upon the firstborn. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne to the firstborn of his lowliest servant girl who grinds the flour. Even the firstborn of all the livestock will die. This was a pretty extensive death plague. And, you know, he says this is going to be on every family in Egypt, which might leave some of us wondering why the whole nation. It seems like Pharaoh is the one responsible for this. Well, we did talk about this some last time, so I'm not going to go into it as much. You can get the audio from last week if you want to hear more on this. But I will make just a couple of points. One is that Pharaoh wasn't the only guilty one. You know, just like Hitler was not the only one responsible for the Nazi atrocities of World War II. and saying, well, he made me do it, is not enough to get you off the hook. You know, this was something that the whole nation was guilty of. The oppression of the Israelites, including, remember, the killing of the infants, the killing of the baby boys, back in Exodus chapter 1. The Egyptians could have defected at any time, and many of them had. You know, by the time of plague 4, the narrative is clearly telling us there was a difference between the land where the Israelites were and the land where the Egyptians were. And so, you know, at any time they could have gone right over there to where it was safe. And many had, in fact, done that. They were listening to what Moses was saying, and then they were doing that to gain the protection of God. We are also going to see that God is going to give them a way out here, just like he has in some of the other plagues. He's going to provide not just the Israelites, but also the Egyptians with a way to pass out from under the judgment of this 10th and final plague. Now, why death? Some of us might be wondering that, you know, maybe that seems a little bit extreme to some people. Well, a couple things we need to keep in mind. One is that death is inevitable. It's not like these people weren't going to die, and then, you know, this plague brought death into their lives. You know, all these people were going to die anyway. The Bible tells us that the length of our life is in God's hands. He's got the very days of our lives numbered. He knows when we will pass away, and that's under his control. And so shortened length of life isn't the worst thing that can happen to you. You know, just, you know, maybe they would have lived another 5 years, another 10 years. What God is really doing here is, in some cases, he's shortening the lives of some of these people and taking them earlier maybe than they would have otherwise. And from God's perspective, there's something that's a lot more important, which is your eternal destiny. That even after your body dies, your soul will live on for eternity. And, you know, the real question is, what's going to happen to you after death? That's the real important question here. There's also the issue of the age of accountability. You know, Scripture seems to indicate that when, you know, the children that are dying here, if they die before a certain age, where it's called an age of accountability, where they, as it says in Isaiah 7, where they know enough to distinguish between right and wrong. It's almost like they've got a chance to decide for themselves. That if they die before that certain age, that they will pass right on into the presence of God. And so for a lot of these kids in this, you know, actually, you know, they go to sleep one night and they wake up in the presence of God. So it really worked out pretty well for them. So the age of accountability is something to keep in mind here as we think about this. One other point here on this is that one day God would give his only son. That God actually would send his son, Jesus Christ, one day, God the Son, and that he would also experience death, that he would taste death even though he didn't deserve to at all, and that he would actually come in and take judgment, the very, you know, similar to the kind of judgment that God is going to deal out here on the Egyptians. And so all the firstborn will die in every family in Egypt, it says. And then it says, a loud wail will rise throughout the land of Egypt, a wail like no one has heard before or will ever hear again. But among the Israelites, it will be so peaceful that not even a dog will bark. That's just how peaceful and serene it's going to be. You know, even like the two yappy dogs across the street, even they are not going to bark at this time here. A miracle. Then you know that Yahweh makes a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. So again, he's distinguishing. All the officials of Egypt will run to me, Moses says, and bow and fall to the ground before me. But Pharaoh didn't like that too much, that they're going to bow before Moses. And they're going to say, please leave, hurry, and take all of your followers with you. Only then will I go. And then, burning with anger, Moses left Pharaoh and storms out. Well, here before he gives us the details of the final plague, he gives us just a brief little summary, like he's done at several points so far in this book. It says, Yahweh had told Moses earlier, Pharaoh will not listen to you, but then I will do even more mighty miracles in the land of Egypt. And Moses and Aaron performed these miracles in Pharaoh's presence, but Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he wouldn't let the Israelites leave the country. And so this is proceeding exactly according to plan thus far. God called all this in advance. He's totally in control. And now it's finally time for him to implement this thing that he predicted. You know, it's kind of easy to skip over a lot of the predictive prophecy in the Bible because it's already happened. But, you know, for them, you know, this is him predicting all these, the sequence of events long before it had happened. And so in Exodus 12, he says, while the Israelites were still in the land of Egypt, Yahweh gave the following instructions to Moses and Aaron. And so God is going to explain to them instructions for what's called the Passover. And the rest of this chapter is devoted to that, with just a little bit for how it's actually implemented. But really, it's teaching them what they're supposed to do for this Passover. This is a festival that, you know, there's going to be this one-time event that's going to happen just a few days from this time here. But then there's going to be an annual event that looks back to this. And as we read here, what we see is that the focal point of this Passover celebration is this Passover lamb. A Passover lamb. And the events that are recorded here, they had very, you know, tremendous significance for the people of this day, and yet they also pointed forward. There was a significant teaching element, a predictive element to the events of the Passover. And we read about this in the New Testament, that there are significant parallels between this Passover, and specifically this Passover lamb, and Jesus Christ. As it says in 1 Corinthians 5, "For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed." And so the things we're going to read about here, as we read along, we're also going to try to understand the relationship between what's given here and who Jesus was and what he would someday do. So let's read. Exodus chapter 12, verse 2. And the first thing it talks about is the choice of the lamb. When and how to select this lamb. There's five verses devoted to this. So it's apparently pretty important. He says, "From now on, this month will be the first month of the year for you." God says, you know, whatever calendar you've been using so far, I want you to throw it out. This month is your first month of the year. I want you to get a new planner. I want you to reset your clocks. I want you to reset your odometer. Everything starts from this point right here. This is ground zero. This lamb. Once this lamb comes into your life, this is a new beginning. And some of us, you know, maybe we're feeling like my life is a mess right now. I've got all these problems I don't know how to deal with. If I'm honest, I've contributed to these at the very least. Maybe I'm the primary cause of these, and I need a new beginning. And what God promises is no matter where you're at in your life, you can have a new beginning. Thanks to this lamb. And so this is the first month of the year. At this point, they called it Abib. Later on, it actually, once they went to Babylon, they would change it. They would call it the month of Nisan. Nisan. And kind of like the car company. And later on, actually, they switch. So they go back to celebrating the new year back in the fall. And this is the middle of the year. But God's original intention was that the Passover is the start of the year. It's also the start of the harvest. And he says, "I want you to announce to the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each family must choose a lamb or a young goat for a sacrifice, one animal for each household." So it could be a lamb or a goat. Lamb or a goat. And he says, "I want you to choose this for a sacrifice." And so on the 10th of Nisan, they would pick this animal. And then they would actually keep a close eye on this animal for 4 days. They said, "If a family is too small to eat a whole animal, let them share with another family in the neighborhood." And so he's like, you know, if you got a small family, I want you to team up with as many families as you need to get together with to eat a lamb. You know, 10, 12, 14 people could eat pretty well on one lamb. And so, what he doesn't want here is he doesn't want any leftovers, as we're going to see. And actually what they're doing is they're trying to calculate how much lamb do we need for the number of people that we had. And so the provision of the lamb is being specially tailored to the needs of the people. Divide the animal according to the size of the family and how much they can eat. The animal you select must be a one-year-old male, either a sheep or a goat with no defects. So relatively young, the breeding season was such they were always born right around this time of year. So there would be an abundance of one-year-olds. And he says, "I don't want you to pick the one that's got kind of like, you know, kind of a limp or, you know, missing an ear or blind, one that was going to die anyway." He says, "I want you to pick the perfect one, one with no defects, one young, right on the verge of adulthood, right in early adulthood, and I want you to choose that lamb." And he says later in this chapter, he says, "In fact, I don't even want you to break any of the bones when you kill this thing." And it's interesting, as we read our New Testament, what we see is that John claims that this was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. When he died on the cross, It says that they did not break any bones in fulfillment of this. In John 19, it says the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man who had been crucified with Jesus, and then those of the other. That's what they would do when they would crucify people, is, you know, they would nail them to the cross, and there'd also be a nail right through their feet. And in order to breathe, they would have to push up so that they could actually have the air fill their lungs. And at a certain point, when they got tired of waiting for the prisoners to die, they would go through and they would break the legs so they couldn't push up anymore, and they would suffocate. Well, they killed the two criminals with Jesus, but when they got to him, they found he was already dead, and so they did not break his legs. And so John actually says these things happen so the scripture would be fulfilled. Not one of his bones will be broken. You see, Jesus had to be perfect in order to qualify as our Passover lamb. Just like God said, your Passover lamb needs to be perfect as well. Isaiah 53 tells us this as well. Also a predictive prophecy, 700 years before Jesus. It says that he was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. So it talks about his perfection. There's no violence, no deceit. This was undeserved, and yet he died anyway. And yet he died willingly. He died quietly, like a lamb led to the slaughter. He says, I want you to take special care of this chosen animal until the evening of the 14th day of this first month. I want you to, you know, just kind of like hang out with it for 4 days. This is like your pet from the 10th through the 14th. And that way you can really observe, okay, you know, he looked pretty good at first, but every time he eats, he pukes it back up again. And so you're like, okay, that's not going to work. We need to get a different one. It also gave plenty of time, so this was not something that was thrown together at the last minute, because the meal was actually going to be eaten in haste. And so they observed this animal for 4 days, and then on the evening, it says that the whole assembly of the community of Israel must slaughter their lamb or young goat at twilight. At twilight. And so as the sun is starting to go down, now at twilight here, Josephus tells us that twilight began around 3 p.m. and lasted until 5 p.m. And isn't it interesting that we read the book of John, or sorry, the book of Matthew, it says at about 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out in a loud voice. And he cried out, it is finished. And that's when he gave up his spirit. That's when he died. And so at the very moment when the rest of Israel was going out to slaughter their Passover lamb, Scripture tells us that our Passover lamb also was killed, was also slain, right at the beginning of this window here. Well, the selection of the lamb we've seen. Now, what about the blood of the lamb? Verse 7 tells us about this. It says, they're to take then some of the blood, now the lamb has been killed, and to smear it on the sides and on the top of the door frames of the houses where they eat the animal. They're actually supposed to take a bundle of branches from a hyssop plant, which is a pretty common plant back then, and they would dip it in the blood, and they would use it as kind of like a paintbrush to just smear that blood all over their doorposts, the top, the sides, there was stuff on the bottom as well. And so they're just making a bloody mess out of their front door with the blood of the lamb. And you need to do that not just on any house, but on the house where you're going to eat the lamb, where you're going to eat this meal. You see, the blood symbolized life and death. You know, some people are like, oh man, the blood. Why is the Bible always talking about the blood this and the blood that? You know, blood was a symbol of life. You know, when the blood is in you, you're alive. And they could tell, you know, when you slit that animal's throat and drain it out, the blood goes out and the life goes out as well. And so whether the blood was in or out, that's, you know, determined whether the animal was alive or dead. And so blood out symbolized a death had occurred. It's like a marker, a token, a symbol. Leviticus 17 explains this really well. Also written by Moses, he says, for the life of the body is in its blood. I've given you the blood on the altar to purify you, making you right with Yahweh. It uses the word atonement in many of our translations. In atonement, what that says is, okay, now, really, you should die. But this animal is going to die, and this blood then, in this case, is smeared on the altar. That's what makes you right. That's what there's a symbolic transaction taking place here. You should have died, but this animal here is dying in your place. This animal is dying instead. He says, it is the blood given exchange for a life that makes purification possible. And so, you know, God is coming in judgment on this entire area here, in this 10th plague. And what he's saying is, you know, there will be death in every household. The question is, will it be the death of a lamb or will it be the death of the firstborn? That's the choice that they had before them. It's also forcing them, though, to take action. The blood symbolized life and death, but it's also forcing them to do something here. It's giving them a step that they need to take. You remember how in the other plagues, God would differentiate between the Israelites and the Egyptians, but that wouldn't happen until the plague happened. You know, it'd be like everybody's standing there, and then, like, you know, all the Egyptian cows die. And the Israelite ones are still standing. They're like, oh, okay, cool. In this case here, though, before God did anything, he's calling on them to step forward, to take action. God is basically saying, do you want in or out? Are you going to voluntarily take this step of faith? Take this action based on your trust in what I'm telling you here. That's what he's calling on them to do. There's, you know, it wasn't just enough for the lamb to die. What needed to happen was the blood needed to be applied. And then, as it says later in this chapter, they needed to stay in the house where the blood was on the door when the angel of death comes. Now, what about the meal of the lamb? The meal here. He says, that same night they must roast the meat over a fire and eat it along with bitter salad greens and bread made without yeast. All right, so the first priority was to get that blood on the door. Then they could eat. And so the elements here in this meal, you know, first he says you need to roast the meat over a fire. What's the significance of that? Well, with all of these, the point here is it's got to be quick. This is a meal eaten on the go. You know, roasting over a fire would have been the fastest and cleanest method. You know, he says you're not supposed to eat it raw, like some of the, you know, pagan religions do. Also, boiling would require getting a pot, heating the water, throwing it in there. There'd be dishes to clean afterward. You know, it's basically barbecue, okay? You know, you roast this thing, all you needed to do is have something to stick through it. You can hold it over the fire, and then when it's done, you can just kind of cut parts off of it and eat it. And so they'd be able to do that. That was the fastest way to cook it, and that was also the fastest cleanup time. Also, bitter salad greens. What's the point of this? Well, bitter herbs could be found and prepped quickly. It was something they could just they knew how to find, and they could sear them or they could just eat them raw. And so again, there's an element of haste in this. Also, it was a reminder of their bitter slavery, how the Egyptians had made life bitter for the Israelites. It could be tempting, and we'll actually see once they get out of Egypt and things get kind of hard, they start to have this good old day syndrome with their time in Egypt. They start just remembering how awesome life was there, and they even start proposing going back to Egypt at several points that we'll see here. And so God is trying to remind them, you know, I mean, the text never says that that's what this is for, but later Jews attach this significance to it, and I think it's right. A reminder of their bitter slavery. You know, as they eat this meal and as they taste these bitter herbs, they're supposed to be reminded of their cruel bondage and what God saved them from. To never forget. Also, the bread made without yeast. What's that all about? Well, this cut the prep time for bread making from several hours down to a few minutes. You know, the yeast it takes time for the yeast to cause the bread to rise. And you have to wait till it's risen before you can bake it. But if you didn't wait for the yeast, if there's no yeast in there, then you just mix it together, you bake it up real quick, and you could be out in a few minutes. It does not taste good. If you've ever had unleavened bread, it tastes really bad. It's like a saltine, but a lot worse. There's no salt. It's not a pleasant, kind of a meal, really. So the bread needs to be made without yeast. Also, later on, yeast actually came to symbolize sin. For example, 1 Corinthians 5:8. Again, so he's just said, Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. And then he says, therefore, let us keep the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth. Part of what he's calling them to do here is they were tolerating some pretty rampant sin in their group. A guy was sleeping with his mom, which which is gross. And so he says, you know, let's get that yeast out of here, this sin in your group, and let's celebrate the Passover with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And so he's explaining, you know, so there probably would have been some connotations of that as well. He says, don't eat any of the meat raw or boiled in water. The whole animal, including the head, legs, and internal organs, must be roasted over a fire. And so it doesn't mean they didn't clean out the intestines, but it was a very quick cleaning process, and then they would roast it up. Don't leave any of it till the next morning. Burn whatever is not eaten before morning. He says it twice there. He says no leftovers. This is like the day before you leave for vacation, you know. You're trying to clean out the fridge. You're like pounded milk. Eating the half-eaten ramen, you're trying to eat that down. Wouldn't want that to go to waste. And so he does, you know, he doesn't want this to be just lying around, to be desecrated, some kind of superstitious element to this. So he says, if your calculations are off, which you should have calculated so that you exactly have enough food for the number of people. But if you're wrong, then just burn the rest. He says, these are your instructions for eating this meal now. Be fully dressed. Wear your sandals and carry your walking stick in your hand. Eat the meal with urgency, for this is Yahweh's Passover. Okay, so fully dressed, that doesn't mean like no naked Passovers. he's talking about you've got your coat on, you've got all your clothes on, you're ready to go. You know, you wear your sandals. You didn't wear sandals inside the house back then. Also, your walking stick was not something you carried around. That was an outdoor tool. And so he's like, I want you to be sitting there. You've got your stick in the one hand. You've got your lamb and your herbs and your bread in the other hand. And you are ready to go. Eat the meal with urgency, for this is Yahweh's Passover. And yet, you got to wonder how they might have been feeling eating this. You know, some of them, I would imagine, were feeling kind of scared. And imagine, you know, they've been here for 430 years. This is where they'd grown up. They'd built houses. They'd raised their families here. They had been raised here. Their great-great-great-great-grandparents lived here. And here they were, ready to uproot and leave everything. You know, that would have been pretty terrifying, you know, sitting there, all dressed up and ready to go. The bags are packed. And we're just waiting for the word from Moses for Pharaoh to set us free. I would imagine that some of the other ones, though, were feeling a little bit foolish. You know, here we are, all dressed up, ready to go, and it's like, you know, what makes us think that after 430 years we're going to get out of here? You know, nine plagues deep, and Pharaoh has not budged at all. He seems to be getting even angrier. We've just gotten harsher treatment from this. And, you know, you would just feel like pretty stupid. Yeah, so God's just going to show up, and tonight he's going to set us free. You know, you'd feel like you're sitting there waiting for the great pumpkin or something like that. And it was an act of faith. God was saying, look, get dressed, get ready to go. I mean, you'd feel like, you know, it's like a drought and you're sitting there wearing your skis and your snow equipment. And you're like, okay, I'm just waiting for the big snowstorm, which is completely unlikely. And so we need to eat it in haste. This is a to-go order. You know, this is drive-through. This is... we are eating this as quickly as possible, and then at the moment where God gives us the signal, we load the rest of the stuff up and we go. The meal of the Lamb. Now, what about the protection of the Lamb? That's what he talks about in these next two verses. He says, on that night I will pass through the land of Egypt, and I will strike down every firstborn son and firstborn male animal in the land of Egypt. I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt, for I am Yahweh. This was an act of judgment. But the blood on your doorposts will serve as a sign, marking the houses where you're staying. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. That's where we get the term Passover. This plague of death will not touch you when I strike the land of Egypt. So what he's saying here is that the lamb really served as your substitute. The lamb serves as your substitute. When I see the blood, when I see the life has been taken, then I will pass over because the death has already occurred in that household. Will it be the blood of the lamb, or will it be a different kind of death? That's up to them. That was their choice. But God was laying out his terms. The blood is what I need to see. Really, nothing will protect you other than the blood of the lamb. There's nothing else you can smear on this doorpost that is going to get the angel of death to pass over. No amount of money you can stick out there. No other substance that you can put out there. Nothing but the blood of the Lamb is effective here. 1 Peter says, you know that God paid a ransom to save you from the empty life you inherited from your ancestors. And the ransom he paid was not mere gold or silver. God paid a ransom from the futile and empty way of life that you were living. He says it was the precious blood of Christ, the sinless, spotless Lamb of God. God chose him as your ransom long before the world began. But he's now revealed him to you in these last days. Oh yeah, this is not a surprise to God. Long before the creation of the world, God knew the direction the human race would take. He knew that of our choice to rebel against him. And he knew the solution that he would have. A solution that no one expected. That he would send his one and only Son. The precious blood of Christ. The death of God the Son, who didn't deserve to die, would then die in our place as our ransom, as our substitute, to purchase us out of slavery, to rescue us. Nothing can be added to the blood of the Lamb either. You know, not only can nothing substitute for it, but nothing can be added to it either. It alone is what we need for salvation. Hebrews 10 puts it this way. He says, for God's will is for us to be made holy, different, cleansed by the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all time. Once for all time. There's no need to repeat this. The Exodus could not, the Passover could not be repeated. It was a one-time event. Once they left Egypt, all they could do was remember it and point back to what God had done. But the actual act, the smearing of the blood, the salvation from judgment, that was a one-time event. Once for all time, Jesus Christ offered himself up as our sacrifice. He doesn't say, when I see the blood and that you're really good, I'll pass over you. You know, that there's one condition. When I see the blood, not blood and there's you're a pretty good person. No way. The blood alone is God's condition. He doesn't say this either. When I see the blood and that you're really sincere about this, that you really mean it, that you really believe that the blood is going to cover you. I bet you there was some doubters in there. But you know what? They believed enough to put the blood on the doorposts. They believed enough to get inside the house. That was the important thing. Jesus says, faith the size of the smallest thing you can think of. That's all you need. Mustard seed size faith. He doesn't say, when I see the blood and I see that you feel close to God, I will pass over you. It's not about your feelings of closeness to God. It's about the objective reality. Blood or no blood? That's the question. That's what you need to be concerned about. That's what you need to be focused on. And unless we keep our anchor there, we'll find ourselves adrift in our spiritual lives. We need to go back to the blood, focused on the blood of the Lamb. He says, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Those are his terms. And so the question is, when you stand before God, what will he find on your door? When midnight strikes, when the angel of death, when the destroyer, when God himself is standing before you, what will be on the door? What will you claim? What will you plead at that point? Will you plead your own works? Will you say, I was a good person? Or will you say, look at the Lamb. Look at the blood. Look at Christ. That's the question that you're going to have to answer. And you know, they'd had plenty of time, but now finally, the time had come to make a decision. Where will you stand? Will you throw in with God or not? And then he talks about the memorial of the Lamb. So the choosing of the Lamb, the blood of the Lamb, the meal of the Lamb, the protection of the Lamb. And finally, then, we talk about how to look back at what God did here. He says, this is a day to remember. Each year, from generation to generation, you must celebrate it as a special festival to Yahweh. This is a law for all time. I don't want you to ever forget this. He says, it's a day to remember. And again, it's fascinating to read the Gospels and to note that the Last Supper, the meal Jesus enjoyed on the final night of his life, was actually a Passover meal. Being from Northern Galilee, they would actually celebrate it after sundown on the previous day. So the rest of the southern Israelites would celebrate it on the actual day of. And Jesus says, just before this, he says, I've longed to eat this Passover meal with you. And then it says he took some bread, this unleavened bread, and he gave thanks to God for it, and then he broke it in pieces and gave it to the disciples. And he said, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this to remember me. He says, I'm making a new covenant with you, a new promise, a new relationship, he goes on to say. And, you know, instead of remembering the Passover, the thing that you guys have been remembering for 1,500 years or so, I just want you to remember me. Okay? No more Passover. We have now the Passover lamb, the one to whom the Passover was pointing. He says, I want you to remember me now. And so the Lord's Supper becomes our way as Christians to remember what Jesus did, much like the way that, you know, the Passover was their way to remember that fateful night in Egypt when God set them free. And then he says, after Passover, I want you to do a seven-day festival. For 7 days, the bread you eat must be made without yeast. It's the festival of unleavened bread or unyeasted bread. On the first day of the festival, remove every trace of yeast from your homes. So we need a sterile, yeast-free environment to celebrate this this weekend. And it's funny, actually, the modern Jews that try to take this seriously, one of the ways that they implement this is in order to get all the yeast out of their homes. I learned about this a few years back. My in-laws were having a house built by like an Orthodox observant Jew. And, you know, the house was already way over behind schedule, and they were living in a hotel room because they had sold their house like a month or two ago. And they find out the builder is going on vacation for a week. And they're like, what are you doing? Why don't you finish our house? And he's like, sorry, I can't. I got to go celebrate Passover. And they're like, why can't you do it here? And he's like, well, my options are either to clear out all the yeast from my house, or you lock the house up and you go to these like unleavened Passover resorts that are totally kosher, and you have like a week of, you know, unleavened luxurious living. So, I mean, I guess there's two ways to live in a house with no leaven. I kind of like that way, actually. But he says, anyone who eats bread made with yeast during these 7 days of the festival will be cut off from the community. On the first day of the festival, and again on the seventh day, all the people must observe an official day for a holy assembly. No work of any kind may be done in those days except in the preparation of food. Celebrate this festival of unleavened bread, for it will remind you that I brought your forces out of the land of Egypt on this day. This festival will be a permanent law for you as well. Celebrate this day from generation to generation. The bread you eat must be made without yeast from the evening of the 14th day of the first month until the evening of the 21st day of that month. All right, we get it. No yeast. During those 7 days, there must be no trace of yeast in your homes. Uh-huh. Anyone who eats anything made with yeast during this week will be cut off from the community of Israel. These apply both to foreigners and to native-born Israelites, actually. So he says, you know, later in the chapter, he says, if you're not an Israelite and you want to do Passover, then you should convert to the Israel faith, which included getting circumcised, and then you can do the Passover. So he gave them a way in on this. And again, during those days, you must not eat anything made with yeast. Wherever you live, eat only bread made without yeast. Really important point. He's trying to get them to remember this Passover, you know, and trying to really stake out that, you know, unleavened bread would have been something they would have only eaten during this time of the year. And so Moses called all the elders of Israel together, and he said to them, and he lays out the instructions that God has given them here. And then in verse 25, he says, when you enter the land Yahweh has promised to give you, you will continue to observe this ceremony. And then your children will ask, Daddy, what does this ceremony mean? And you will reply, it is the Passover sacrifice to Yahweh. For he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt, and though he struck the Egyptians, he spared our families. And so he says, I want your kids to know this. And they actually would have, at Passover today, they actually have kind of a Q&A that they play out where the youngest child is supposed to ask that question. And then the oldest guy there is supposed to lay out the Passover story, the Exodus story. and he spared our families. And it wasn't just kind of this general thing that God wanted them to understand, but we see in chapter 13, he says, you got to explain to your kids, I'm celebrating what Yahweh did for me when I left Egypt. This is something that applies to me personally. I smeared the blood on my door. I ate the lamb. I personally partook of this. This was not something that was just generally, you know, something that God did for all of us, but it's something he did for me personally as well. And this is it's the decision to receive Christ's forgiveness is something that has to be personally chosen by you personally. It's not something you can be born into or that somebody else can decide for you. It's a decision you've got to make. When Moses had finished speaking, all the people bowed down to the ground and worshiped. Just like they had back in chapter 4, they do it again. They believe him, and they do what God said. And so the people of Israel did just as Yahweh had commanded through Moses and Aaron. And in verse 29 and 30, in two very simple verses, God narrates how he brought to an end 430 years of bondage. That night at midnight, Yahweh struck down all the firstborn sons in the land of Egypt. From the firstborn son of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn son of the prisoner in the dungeon. Even the firstborn of their livestock were killed, just like he said he was going to do. It's a pretty somber moment here, this judgment that God levels on the Egyptians, on anybody who did not have the blood on their doorposts. I've got a picture Bible at home that kind of depicts it this way. It's a pretty intense view of the destroyer, the angel of death. You know, they've kind of got it drawn with the Egyptian houses right next to the Israelite houses, but you can see the blood on the doorposts there on the houses on the right. And then the ones on the left having their worst nightmare come true. You know, up until that point, they had a choice. But once midnight struck, the time for choosing was done. The choice needed to be made before then, before it was too late. And in verse 30, it says, Pharaoh and all his officials and all the people of Israel woke up during the night, and loud wailing was heard throughout the land of Egypt. There was not a single house where someone had not died. You know, that's actually even true of the Israelites. In their houses, though, it was a lamb. It's not their firstborn. So Pharaoh sent for Moses and Aaron during the night. And he said, get out. Leave my people. Take the rest of the Israelites with you. Go and worship Yahweh as you've requested. Take your flocks and your herds as you said and be gone. There's this really powerful scene in the old version of the Ten Commandments where Pharaoh's son dies. And he takes his child and he brings it up to this statue that he has of his God. And he lays it in his God's arms and he says, look, I believed in you. Will you bring my son back to life? And there's no answer. There's no answer from his gods. Yahweh was executing judgment on all the gods of the Egyptians and showing them that I alone am God. There is no other. And then he says this. He says, go, but bless me as you leave. Not that he's put his faith, his trust in God, and yet he's got this superstition thing. It's like he's angling here to get something, and he asks for a blessing as they leave. This would have just been a message he sent to Moses and Aaron. You know, they would have been over in Goshen ready to go that night. And it says, all the Egyptians then urged the people of Israel to get out of the land as quickly as possible, for they thought we will all die. They didn't know where the death was going to stop. And so they're insisting, they're demanding, they're driving out the Israelites, which, you know, I think God probably used to help get them out of there. There might have been some that would have straggled and stayed behind, but they're just saying, look, you have no choice. You're not wanted here. Get out of here. And so they took their bread dough before yeast was added, and they wrapped their kneading boards in their cloaks, and they carried them on their shoulders. And the people of Israel did as Moses had instructed. They asked the Egyptians for clothing and articles of silver and gold. They're kind of going door to door on their way out, asking for donations. And you know, that's a pretty motivated audience right there to just give them whatever they could to get them out of there. You know, God's funding their journey. And also, this gold is going to be used both for the tabernacle God would have them make, as well as for a golden calf that they would bow down and worship, unfortunately. We'll study that in a few weeks. But it says, Yahweh caused the Egyptians to look favorably on the Israelites, and so they gave the Israelites whatever they asked for. So they stripped the Egyptians of their wealth. A multitude of non-Israelites went with them, along with great flocks and herds of livestock. And so many Egyptians decided to, and other nationalities, as we'll find out, they decided to join in with Yahweh. These were probably people that had kept the Passover as well and decided to throw their lot in with the God who was there. The people of Israel had lived in Egypt for 430 years. In fact, it was on the last day of the 430th year that all Yahweh's forces left the land. On this night, Yahweh kept his promise to bring his people out of the land of Egypt. So this night belongs to him, and it must be commemorated every year by all the Israelites from generation to generation. And so God keeps his promise that he made to Abraham. You're going to be in a foreign land for 400 years, oppressed. On your way out, you're going to strip them of all their wealth, and I'm going to then lead you to the promised land. And so this night belongs to Yahweh, he says, and you're never going to forget this. You need to intentionally take time to recall and remember what he has done. Yahweh, the God that keeps his promises. Well, let me just make a few final observations here. You know, Passover has two aspects. One aspect of Passover refers to the final night in Egypt. The final night in Egypt, where God's judgment came, where midnight struck, and God was standing there. And where he took the lives of those that did not have the blood of the Lamb on their doorposts. This great rescue, this great act of judgment, this great deliverance by God. And as Christians, that corresponds to the death of Christ. The death of our Passover lamb. A one-time sacrifice for all that has cleansed us for all time. And nothing can be added to it, can never be repeated, only remembered. And that's the second aspect of Egypt. Out of Egypt, once they got out, they were also to celebrate Passover, but in a different way. Not because the angel of death would show up again, but to remember that night, to remember God's deliverance, to thank God for what he has done for them and for what he has saved them from. And as Christians, God calls on us to remember as well. Jesus told his disciples to do that on the night before his death. He says, I don't ever want you to forget what I'm about to do. Nothing can be added to it, but it needs to be remembered. And I'd like to leave you with a scene from the book of Revelation. The Lamb features prominently in the book of Revelation. We meet the Lamb in Revelation chapter 5, where the Apostle John is given this scene of the throne room of heaven. And he begins weeping because there's no one found who's worthy to open this book that would send the final events of human history into motion. But then it says, one of the elders next to him said, stop weeping, look. Look. And he says, and I saw the lion of the tribe of Judah, and yet it looked like a lamb that had been slain. Jesus Christ. And John says in chapter 7, verses 13 through 17, again, it's another dialogue he's having in heaven. He says, then one of the 24 elders asked me, who are these who are clothed in white? Where do they come from? There's this vast multitude of people wearing white robes around the throne, praising the Lamb. And I said to him, sir, you're the one who knows. And then he said to me, they've washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb, and they've made them white. That's why they stand in front of God's throne and serve him day and night in his temple. If you want to be in heaven, you're going to need to wash your robe in the blood of the Lamb. And he who sits on the throne will give them shelter. And they will never again be hungry or thirsty. They will never be scorched by the heat of the sun. For the Lamb on the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of life-giving water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. Thank you, Lord, for this story, this picture, Lord, that you've given us here, Lord. Thank you that you've revealed to us who you are, God, and thank you that you have warned us of the coming judgment. And also that you have personally provided a way out of that judgment, Lord, that we can pass out of death and into life. We know, Lord, the scriptures say that you love the world so much that you gave your only Son, that whoever believes in him won't perish but have eternal life. And that you say, too, that Jesus didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but the world already stood condemned. And so I thank you, Lord, that you've given it the option of forgiveness And that's based not on us at all, Lord, but it's based entirely on you. And I pray we can keep our eyes focused on that, no matter what's going on in our lives. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.